All right, well, let's open our Bibles once again to the book of 2 Samuel, and we are ready for the third chapter, 2 Samuel chapter 3. And, you know, we find ourselves really in the midst of a civil war that's going on between what we have is Abner to the north. Now, he's not little Abner, he's big Abner, and he's to the north, and he is sort of propping up the house of Saul, and then we have David to the south, and he is primarily being followed by the house of Judah. Now, the question that we could ask ourselves is why do we have this conflict? I mean, why is this going on, and why does it go on for 7 years, 7.5 years? I mean, after all, was it not God's will? Was David not God's choice? Was it not God's will that David should rule over all of the house of Israel? Of course it was. Well, why is that not happening? Now, oftentimes when we find ourselves in the scripture and there's a bit of a puzzle going on, so frequently God will take the key that'll unlock the door right on the door itself. And I believe that the reason for all of the conflict, the reason why this process is taking such a long period of time, is what we are told in really the opening verses here of chapter 3, where we read, "Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. Now David, he grew stronger and stronger. And the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker." Then notice we have a listing of the sons that were born unto David. That in verse 2, we have his first son, who was Amnon. His second son, in verse 3, was Chileab. The third son was Absalom. And then in verse 4, the fourth son was Adonijah. And then the fifth son was Hattiah. And then the sixth son was Arithim. And these were the children that were born unto David. Now, notice that David has six sons that are born unto him. Now, how many daughters he had born at this time, we don't know. But here he has six sons born unto him, and they are given to him by six different women. Now, tonight after Bible study, if there was someone here and you got talking to them afterwards and you found out a little bit about them and you found out that they had six kids with six different women, I doubt very seriously that you would have a very high opinion of that individual, right? But here we have the great man of God. Here we have the guy that wrote the Psalms. Here we have a guy who has a heart after God, and yet this guy is sleeping with everything that's wearing a dress, you know, in the local village, you know? And this is the problem that's going on with the guy. I mean, remember that the law clearly stated that a king was not to multiply wives. And what's the first thing that this guy starts doing? But he begins to add to his harem. Now, you cannot live in a way that is totally contrary to the Word of God and expect God to bless your life. How can David continue to live his life in such a way that flies in the face of what God commanded the kings and then expect to turn around, "Oh, God bless me. Oh, God give me all of Israel to rule over"? So it is obviously David's sin, David's selfishness, that's causing so much of the problem in the guy's life. And I wonder how many times in our lives when we look at all of the problems that we're facing, how many of those problems are really rooted in our unwillingness to live our lives before God the way that God is desiring us to live. Now, all of these children, what's interesting, you can imagine the insecurity, you can imagine the jealousy that was going on in this man's house. Every one of these boys grows up to be a bandit. I mean, there isn't a one of them here that grows up to be worth a hill of beans. But again, when you got dad sleeping with everything in the village, I mean, what do you expect the children to be? And so I think that the opening verses here of chapter 3 really show us the problem with what's holding up the show. Well, then in verse 6 we read, "And it came to pass that while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner made himself strong in the house of Saul. And Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah. She was the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said unto Abner, 'Why have you gone in to my father's concubine?'" Now, I believe that Abner was probably overall a pretty decent guy. And I think that Abner was a guy that had character. I think that there was a little bit of integrity in this man. And one thing that we know about men who have character is that they get very angry when their character is being called into question. I halfway believe that this is one of the reasons why Abner was originally against David. Because you remember that David challenged him publicly. Hey, Abner, you're sleeping on the job. I thought you're supposed to be watching the king. If you're doing such a good job watching the king, why do I have the king's spear? And that was probably enough that torqued Abner off that at the death of Saul, he didn't throw his support behind David. Now this half-witted, this dim-witted son of Saul now comes and challenges really the guy that's in charge of his military. And he is not only insinuating sexual immorality, but he is also insinuating treason. For when a king had a woman that belonged to him and somebody came in and slept with her, it wasn't just an act of sexuality, it was an act of domain, an act of dominance. It was a way of saying, I now am taking over the show, so to speak. And so he was suggesting, why is it, Abner, that you are perpetrating treason upon me? Well, then in verse 8, then Abner was very angry at the words of Ishbosheth, and he said, am I a dog's head? And who against Judah do show kindness this day unto the house of Saul, thy father and his brethren and his friends? And I have not delivered thee into the hand of David, that you chargest me this day with a fault concerning this woman. So do God to Abner and more also, except the Lord has sworn to David, even so do I to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to set up the throne of David from over Israel and over Judah from Dan even to Beersheba. And he could not answer Abner a word because he feared him. Now, in this was all said in the context of Abner was growing in strength, right? Abner is growing in his influence. Perhaps this dim-witted son of Saul felt threatened, and so he challenges him, and his response is, oh, you think I'm taking over? You think I want to be king? Well, here's news for you. I'm going to take what military influence I have, and I'm now going to throw it behind David. I don't want to be king. If I wanted to be king, I never would have put you in charge in the first place. And so now I'm going to throw my allegiance behind David. Now, I do believe that we see a character flaw in this man, though, because notice that he knew what was right. He knew that God had called David. He knew that all of Israel was to be under the authority of David. He is an example of a guy that knew what was right, but for whatever reason was unwilling to do it. Now he's going to do the right thing, albeit he's going to do it for the wrong reason. Well, then in verse 12, Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, whose is the land? Saying also, make a league with me, and behold, my hand shall be with thee, and bring about all of Israel unto thee. And he said, well, and I will make a league with thee, but one thing I require of thee, and that is that you shall not see my face, except you bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. And David sent messengers unto Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, deliver unto me my wife Michal, whom I have betrothed for 100 foreskin of the Philistine. And the Ishbosheth sent and took her and her husband, even from Paltiel, the son of Laish, and her husband went with her, weeping behind her to Bahurim. And then said Abner unto him, go and return, and he returned. Now, I have to believe this is one of the most pathetic scenes in all of the Bible. You know, imagine this. Here is David's ex-wife. She's been living as a married woman to this other man for like 20 years now, right? They have been married for a long period of time. Now, what her feelings are towards him, we're not told, but we obviously see what his feelings are towards her, and that is he loves her. I mean, imagine you're married to a woman, you've been married for a couple of decades, all of a sudden the police break into your house, and they take your wife away from you, and you're, you know, deeply in love with this woman, and you're just heartsick about the whole thing. And so he's following this woman, and he's crying as she's being led away by the authorities. And Abner turns around and he says, go, get away. And of course, the idea is, if you don't leave, I'm going to kill you, right? And what a pathetic, horrible scene. And David, of course, he is the author of all of this. Now, David, of course, he needs another woman, like he needs a hole in his head, right? But now, what was his motivation? Was it pride? Was it the idea, I'm not going to have if I can't have her, nobody's going to have her? Was it trying to strengthen himself politically, showing the country, reminding the country that he is the son-in-law of Saul? Or was it just a sexual issue with the guy? We're just not told. But seeing that this, again, is David adding wives to himself, we then should not be so surprised that all of a sudden there's going to be trouble coming his way. It amazes me how that there are people, and maybe we've experienced in our own life, where there is an inability to connect the dots. And we can see it, but for some reason they can't. Where we'll watch a person, they'll make this bad decision and this bad decision, and this will be the outcome. And they'll come to us and they'll complain about the bad outcome. And you're looking at them like, why don't you get it? Can you not connect the dots? You did this. This was the outcome. You did this over here. And this is the negative thing that happened. You would think that David would, you know, in the times that he's meditating before the Lord, that he would realize, I add wives, trouble come my way. I wonder if there could be a connection here, right? But he doesn't seem to get it. But trouble is coming his way. So in verse 17, Abner had communication with the elders of Israel and said, you sought David in times past to be king over you. Now then do it, for the Lord has spoken unto David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel out of the hand of the Philistines and out of the hand of their enemies. And Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin, and Abner spoke in the hearing in David in Hebron, and it seemed good unto Israel, and it seemed good unto the whole house of Benjamin. So this is a picture of a man who once rejected the king, now he has received the king, and now he is encouraging other people that they too might receive the king. And the flavor of it is, the sooner you do it, the better off you're going to be. And so Abner came to David to Hebron with 20 men with him, and David made Abner and the men who were with him a feast. And Abner said unto David, I will arise and go, and I will gather all of Israel unto my lord the king, that they may make a league with thee, that you may reign over all that your heart desires. And David sent Abner away, and he went with peace. And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from pursuing a troop and brought a great spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he was sent away and he had gone in peace. And Joab and all of the hosts that were with him, when they were come, they were told, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he's gone in peace. And then Joab came to the king and said, now, already you can see developing in the relationship between David and Joab, there's not a great deal of respect from Joab towards David. He says, what have you done? Behold, you have sent him away, and he is gone. And you know that Abner, the son of Ner, that he came to deceive you, to spy on your goings out and your coming in, and to know what you do. And when Joab was come out from David, that he sent messengers after Abner and brought him again from the well at Syrah, but David knew it not. And when Abner was returned to Hebron, Abner took him aside And he spoke unto him quietly, and he smote him under the fifth rib so that he died for the blood of Azahel, his brother. Now, there are several reasons why, of course, he's killing Abner. You know, first of all, Abner was a threat to him in the sense that Abner is the military leader of the north, and now he's making a league with David, and maybe David will replace Joab with Abner. I mean, maybe that might be part of their agreement. But, of course, the chief reason is that you remember that Abner killed his little brother, and Joab made a vow before God. If there's one thing that I do in life, I'm going to make sure that I kill the guy that killed my little brother. Now, I do think that there is a bit of humor here, because remember that Hebron was one of the cities of refuge. Now, in the city of refuge, if you killed a person, whether it's in self-defense or whether it was a manslaughter issue, you could run to a city of refuge. As long as you were in that city, the avenger of blood could not get you. Now, remember, they didn't have police. They didn't have the FBI. The family. If a family lost a loved one, it was up to the family to take vengeance, and they would get their revenge through a destroyer, through the venger of blood, and usually it would be a tough hitman within the family. Now, knowing what a mighty warrior Joab was, it's probably safe to say that in his family, he was the avenger of blood. And so you get the scene, right? Here comes Abner. He comes walking into Hebron. Joab can't touch him, right? He's in Hebron. So he puts his hand over the shoulder of Abner and says, hey, let's go outside the gate. Let's talk out there, all right? And so here's Abner, big, dumb, and happy, you know, not realizing that the guy whose little brother I just killed a week ago has got his arm around me, and he's leading me out of the city of refuge. I wonder what he might have in mind. I wonder what he's going to communicate to me. And so he ends up killing him the very same way that he killed his little brother, and that's running, you know, a weapon right through his stomach. And so Abner is killed. Now, afterward, when David heard it, he said, I and my kingdom are guiltless before the Lord forever from the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and upon all of his father's house, and let there never cease from the house of Joab one who has a hemorrhage, or who is a leper, or who leans upon a staff, or who falls on a sword, or who lacks bread. And so Joab and Abishai his brother slew Abner because he had slain their brother Azahel at Gibeon in the battle. Now, these, remember, were the nephews of David. I mean, they're David's sister's kids, right? And they're half crazy. They're half nuts. And David cannot control these two. And it's a situation where you can't live with them, and you certainly can't live without them, right? And so he curses them, and then he lives with them, is what's going on here. And so he's calling this curse, you know, may they always have a leper in the family, or may somebody always be hungry in the family, or whatever. He is so upset with them that he curses them, but they are so mighty. I mean, they are so courageous on the battlefield that he can't afford to get rid of them. I mean, they're like his, you know, his atomic weapon. I mean, they're like his weapon of mass destruction. Nobody can handle these two. They're not afraid of anything. But the downside of that, of course, is that they just cannot be controlled. And so once again, now David's kingdom is in an uproar. And David said unto Joab and to all of the people that were with him, tear your clothes and gird yourself with sackcloth and mourn for Abner, the king. David himself followed, and they buried Abner in Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice, and he wept at the grave of Abner. And all of the people wept, and the king lamented over Abner and said, died Abner as a fool dieth? Your hands were not bound, nor your feet in fetters. As a man falls before a wicked man, so you fell, and all of the people wept over his. Like, Abner, how could you be so stupid? I mean, you didn't have your hands tied. Your feet weren't in shackles. I mean, come on, guy. Were you born yesterday? So he's just really worked up and upset. How could you let this happen to yourself? And when all of the people came to cause David to eat food while it was yet day, David swore, saying, "So do God to me, and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down." And all of the people took notice of it, and it pleased them. And whatsoever the king did, it pleased all of the people. And all of the people in all of Israel understood that day that it was not the king to slay Abner, the son of Ner. And the king said unto his servants, "Know ye not that there is a prince and a great man that has fallen this day in Israel? And I am this day weak, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah," now that was his sister, "they are too hard for me, and the Lord shall reward the doer of evil according to his wickedness." So the people understood David is not the bad guy in this situation. This was not a plot that was hatched in the mind of David, but really it was the problem with Joab. But again, this whole mess came about as really a result. I suppose the spiritual cause for it was the multiplying of wives and God sending David trouble. And he says, these nephews of mine, they're too hard. And the word hard there in the Hebrew means they're uncontrollable. They're stubborn. They're stiff-necked. I mean, these two guys, they were wild men, and they defied being controlled. And David is just beside himself. He didn't know what to do with them. Well, then in chapter 4, very short chapter, just 12 verses, we read, "And then when Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner was dead in Hebron, his hands were feeble, and all of Israel was troubled." Now, Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, had two captains, and one was Baana, and Baana, and the other one was Rechab, and they were Berethites, so they invented beer apparently, and they were sojourners in Gideon. And then in verse 4, Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when tidings came of Saul and Jonathan out of Jezreel, and his nurse took him and fled. And it came to pass that as she made haste to flee, that he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. Now, these are the only two heirs left in the house of Saul. Now, one is quite old and is in a weakened condition, and the other one is just 12 years old at this time, and he's lame because of an accident that took place when word came back to the palace that Saul and Jonathan had been killed. Apparently, the nurse that was responsible, the caregiver that was responsible for this little boy, was in such a haste to get out of the palace because, for all she knew, David was going to come and sweep control and then kill all of the offspring of Saul. And so, really, out of a defense mechanism for the child, she made a haste to get out of the palace. But in so doing, she dropped the child, or the child fell downstairs or whatever, and apparently never healed properly. So these are the only two heirs now that are left. And the sons of Rimmon, now these two captains, this Rechab and this Baana, they came in at the heat of the day into the house of Ish-bosheth, who laid on his bed at noon. So this guy's taking a siesta. Now, if you're going to take a siesta, you're a king, lock your door. And they came in there into the midst of the house as though they were going to get food. And they smote him under the fifth rib, and Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. And they came into the house, and he laid in his bedchamber, and they smote him, and they slew him, and they beheaded him, and they took his head, and they went away through the plain all night. And they brought the head of Ishbosheth unto David to Hebron, and they said unto the king, behold the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, thy enemy, who sought thy life, and the Lord has avenged my lord the king this day of Saul and of his seed. Now, like so many, these two did not understand the heart of David. I mean, they didn't get it. David did not look at Saul as if Saul were his enemy. Again, this is an amazing thing to me, and you can understand how easy it would be to misunderstand David. Imagine if somebody had stolen 10 or 20 years of your life. I mean, imagine how upset, how angry you would be at them. But there is no bitterness, there is no anger whatsoever in David, and people were constantly misreading him. Again, it's because David trusted in the Lord, and he knew that, look, whatever is coming into my life, it is coming into my life by the hand of God. God is allowing it for whatever purpose, and so therefore, it's making me into the man that God wants me to be. David understood what the big picture was. As you read the Psalms and you see the depth of this man's spirituality, it did not come to him overnight, but it came into his life through year after year of trial and year after year of people hurting him and saying unkind things about him. As God would take this man through the furnace, he would come out the other end being a better man, a stronger man, a more spiritual man. And so David understood that. He's not angry at Saul. He's not angry at the family of Saul. So these guys, again, coming in with the head of one of Saul's, you know, descendants. Now remember, when he had his last meeting with Jonathan, what did Jonathan make him promise? You promise me that you will watch out for my family. I know that you'll be king one day. And when you're king, you make sure that you protect my family. So now, a family member of Jonathan, whose head comes, you know, being carried into the camp of David, and these guys think they're going to get a warm reception. Well, that's not what's going to happen in verse 9. David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, and said, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my soul out of all adversity. When one told me, saying, behold, Saul is dead, thinking that he had brought good tidings, I took a hold of him and I slew him in Ziklag, who thought that I would have given him a reward for his tidings. How much more when wicked men have slain a righteous person in his own house upon his bed, shall I not therefore now requite his blood of your hand and take you away from the earth? And David commanded his young men, and they slew them and cut off their hands and their feet, and they hung them over a pole in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and they buried it in the sepulcher of Abner in Hebron. Now David would have no part of scheming. David would have no part of, look, I don't need to manipulate the situation. I don't need to work the situation out in such a way that God's will is going to be done. And the reason for it is, notice what he says at the end of verse 9. He says, as the Lord liveth, who has redeemed my soul out of every adversity? I mean, God has always been faithful to me. God has always made sure that no matter what adversity came my way, that after a period of time and when I have learned my lesson and when God's will has been done in my life, he delivered me from it. I don't need you boys' help. I don't need you to be whacking the heads off of people that you perceive to be are my enemies or keeping something from me, because I trust in the Lord. So here we have now David trusting in the Lord. And notice what happens. You'll notice that chapter 5 begins, then came all of the tribes unto Hebron, and there they made David their king. You see, what a contrast. Here is David pleasing himself, adding wives, just thinking about himself and thinking about what's going to please him. And what happens? Trouble comes into his life. But then when he begins to live his life, say, no, man, I'm going to trust God. I don't need to manipulate. I don't need to be a schemer. I'm going to trust God, and God's going to work in my life. And then what happens when he trusts God? God works in his life. God brings all of Israel there to Hebron, and they make him the king. And so this is a tremendous lesson for us to learn. That look, when we're living our life, this is what's going to please me. This is what's going to make me happy. Oh, I don't need to pray about it. Oh, I don't need to seek God's will because this is my will and this is what's going to make me happy. All that's going to do is bring trouble into your life. All it's going to do is bring hassle into your life. But when you live your life saying, look, man, I'm going to trust in God and I'm going to want God's plan going forth in my life. Then all of a sudden we find God working and he's delivering us from adversity and he is blessing our life. You want God's plan in your life. You don't want your plan. You want God's plan. And I think what we ought to be praying for is that God, show us your plan. God, bring your plan about. God, I want to be blessed. And so give me a heart that's willing to follow after you. So let's pray that we would be a people that would long to desire to have God's plan in our life.